Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black gold, black gold.
Daily. How I learned to navigate uncertainty by taking the path of least regret. Being diagnosed with aggressive breast cancer a week after giving birth to my second child forced me to question the outcome-driven mindset I had always trusted. And this article is by Parul Samani. We make thousands of choices each day, from what to wear and where to eat, to whether we quit our job, move to a new city, or stay in a relationship. These micro and macro decisions go on to shape our lives, including the fulfillment we experience in the near term and the regret we live within the long term. But we're never really actually taught how to make decisions. Instead, we piecemeal an approach to decision making influenced by our upbringing, our profession, and our peers. My approach was quick, logical, and outcome-oriented. Observing indecision in my upbringing led me to prefer rushing into action over delaying it. My training at MIT and Harvard Business School and a long career in management consulting honed my ability to think analytically, gather data, build the model, and find the answer in the evidence. Through those years, my peers were high achievers, and when it came to choosing a major, an internship, a job, or any other milestone, the best decision was the one that provided the most certainty. It was a sensible, efficient way of thinking, and for years it served me well. But when I was 31 years old, just 1 week after giving birth to my second daughter, I was diagnosed with aggressive breast cancer. I was holding my newborn baby in bed when I received the call. I'm sorry, but the mass is malignant after all. Nobody thought that a lump felt during pregnancy was cause for concern. I was young and pregnant, and doctors assured me it was a clogged milk duct. Now, just days after my newborn was discharged from the NICU, I was facing my own mortality. My old training immediately kicked in. I asked matter-of-fact questions. What's the diagnosis? What treatment is required? What's the next step? It was only when I was told, obviously you'll need to stop breastfeeding soon, that the tears began to flow. Still, in the days and weeks that followed, I leaned on my analytical training. I got second and third opinions. I read studies on the recurrence rates and chemotherapy regimens. My oncologist presented me with two treatment options. The standard of care approach using chemotherapies with the best available longitudinal data on reducing recurrence risk, but with a real risk of long-term side effects on brain and heart health. A novel approach using chemotherapies with minimal toxicity, my hair wouldn't even fall out, that recent research had found to be effective for my subtype, but with limited longitudinal data on its recurrence risk. I was pulled toward wanting to decide quickly and to find the answer in the evidence to maximize my chance of beating cancer. Quick, logical, and outcome-oriented. That approach pointed toward choosing the most aggressive standard of care option, where the best data on the long-term survival rates was available. On paper, that choice made sense. In my body, it did not. I was struggling to finalize a decision. I couldn't focus. I couldn't sleep. I knew I needed to solidify a treatment plan, but something in me kept resisting the choice I thought I was supposed to make. I knew I wanted to treat the cancer aggressively, but I also didn't want to be more aggressive than necessary. I wanted to fight the fire, but not flood the whole house in the process. I realized I wasn't just choosing a treatment plan, I was choosing what kind of regret I could live with. My default decision-making framework suggested the aggressive option, but I worried that I'd regret the unnecessarily high toxicity of that treatment if I developed the long-term side effects that were known risks. That said, I knew that if I chose the more novel approach and my cancer returned, I would even more deeply regret not having been more aggressive. There was clearly no answer, no path of least resistance. That's when I asked myself the question that changed everything. What's my path of least regret? That question changed the way I was thinking. It challenged my default approach of being quick, logical, and outcome-oriented. Instead, it invited me to pause, to listen to my hesitations, and honor my emotions, and to prioritize the process over the results. The reflection that followed led me to a simple but important truth. I would feel most at peace knowing I had approached my treatment aggressively but thoughtfully, with a balance of lifespan and health span in mind. Until then, I had been thinking only within the options I was given, but this new lens pushed me to start with what mattered most to me and work backward. It helped me to see there might be another path that would minimize unnecessary toxicity. So I proposed to one of my doctors a third option. We would begin with a chemotherapy regimen that had proven long-term data behind it. My hair would still fall out, but it was less toxic than the original standard of care plan. Then we would monitor the tumor closely. If it wasn't responding, we could quickly escalate to the more toxic drugs, the ones that carried a higher risk of long-term side effects. But this time, we'd be armed with the understanding that it was necessary. I couldn't guarantee the cancer would never return. I also couldn't guarantee I would avoid lasting effects from treatment. What I was able to do, however, was move through the decision with intention and alignment with my priorities, and trust that even if things didn't work out the way I had hoped, I would at least know I wouldn't have made a different decision based on what I knew at the time. That's how regret is minimized and peace of mind is maximized. In the end, the escalation in my treatment wasn't needed. The tumor didn't just shrink with my third option, it disappeared entirely, and I'm now more than 11 years in remission. But the deepest gift of that experience was not only my outcome, it was the way it changed how I make decisions. Now, when I am faced with a difficult choice, I don't automatically pick the option that could lead to the best potential outcome if everything goes right, but rather the one that could leave me with the most tolerable potential regrets if something goes wrong. While this may sound negative in theory, in practice, it is actually more hopeful and human. The path of least regret asks us to pause long enough to honor our hard emotions, notice the mental roadblocks clouding our thinking, get clear on what we're truly solving for, and work backward from there to craft a path that best aligns with our values and priorities. It is not a promise of certainty. It is a way to move through uncertainty, change, and hard choices with greater clarity, resilience, and intention. Over the years, I've returned to this framework again and again. I've used it at many of life's crossroads beyond cancer, when a layoff left me unsure of how to rebuild my career, when parenting brought choices with no perfect answer, and when caregiving required me to balance love, responsibility, and uncertainty. When it comes to the choices that matter most, we may never get certainty, but we can create something powerful in its place. Clarity about what matters, courage to face the trade-offs, and peace in knowing we chose the path most aligned with our values and priorities. And the book is called The Path of Least Regret, Decide with Clarity, Move Forward with Confidence, and it is by Parul Somani. The Secret Life of Mothers Who Stay Up Late. After the house goes quiet, something sacred begins. A few stolen hours for thought, solitude, and becoming. And this article is by Amy Nesquimatil. I love that particular moment when the house finally exhales. The dog is curled into a croissant shape in her bed. The dishwasher hums its low, almost monkish chant. All the bright overhead and hallway lights click off. Someone down the hall sighs in their sleep, that deep animal certainty that says, I am safe. And only then does it begin, the secret life of mothers who stay up late. This is not rebellion. It's not martyrdom. It's not even exhaustion, though exhaustion hums beneath everything like a power line. It is something quieter, more deliberate. It is a choosing. Ever since I was in college, I've loved working at night. I thought that would end once I became a mom, but I've found the opposite. The late hours bloom into small, private, and needed garden for me. The air feels different, softer. The kitchen light turns forgiving instead of inquiring. Its constant glare at other hours asking what to cook next. Didn't we just make a whole meal a few hours ago? A mother opens the fridge not for nourishment exactly, but for the sound, the hush of a cool air, the small ceremony of choosing something just for herself. Grapes, cold and sweet. Leftover pasta eaten standing up. A square of chocolate hidden from the bright interrogations of daylight or expectations to share in the sweetness. These are not indulgences. They are punctuation marks. In these hours, the mind finally stretches its legs for a working mom who's also an artist in my case. The origin of the word poet is one who makes. And I'd be remiss not to give a shout out to my husband, also an educator and writer, who valiantly takes on the morning routine of signing permission slips and making lunches and driving carpool so that I can rest after a late night. He would be the first to say no shout outs are necessary. It's simply what he believes. A true partnership helps the other with their strengths and offers support with their weaknesses. I'm simply better at the organizing and being the command center of the house because I can look into the future at night. He makes the daytime happen with meal prep and cooking, shopping for groceries, and being a chauffeur to our kids until they're old enough to drive themselves to debate or cross-country practice. There are lists for me to make, yes. The future makes its appearances here. Field trips, orthodontist appointments, a birthday that requires cupcakes shaped like something very specific and impossible, like, true story, a siphonophore. The happy and chaotic logistics of love. But alongside the list come half-finished thoughts, shy ideas, and sentences that knock once and wait. The mother remembers she is not only the keeper of other people's days, she's still a person who wonders. I think often of how the night has always belonged to women, as permission. These are hours in which the needs of others recede and a new freedom emerges, to be present and accountable not only to herself. In the dark, you can hear yourself think without interruption. You can sit with a notebook and not feel rushed to produce something tidy or useful. You can read 3 pages of a book and then stare at the wall for 10 minutes, letting memory surface like a fish you didn't know lived in that pond. This is not a story about resentment. It is important to say that clearly. In my house, love is shared generously. My husband shoulders the lion's share of the daily grind with steadiness that astonishes me. This staying up late is not an escape from him or from family. It is an expansion of myself, a widening, a way to remain porous to wonder, even after the day has wrung me out. Motherhood is loud by necessity. The night offers an antidote. Here, a mother can be wordless or overly wordy. She can write a paragraph she will later delete. She can scroll through photos of birds she'd saved earlier. Look at this wing, this impossible blue, and feel her chest loosen just a bit. She can listen to the refrigerator hum and imagine it as the ocean, as wind through the grass, as proof that something is always keeping watch. In these hours, time behaves differently. It stops demanding evidence. It lets you sit. The clock ticks, but gently, like it's rooting for you. You are allowed to be unfinished. This is what I wanted to celebrate in my book, Night Owl, poems that showcase the tender, flickering life that exists after bedtime, the way a tired heart, given a sliver of quiet, remembers how to glow, the way creativity tiptoes back to you among the shadows, the way joy doesn't always boldly proclaim itself. Sometimes in the dark, it waits to be noticed. Staying up late doesn't steal time from tomorrow. It's about giving something back to yourself tonight. It's about believing that the small pleasures count, that a single thought, shimmering briefly in the dark, might be enough to carry you through the morning, through the week. I admit the days are long gone when I could stay up late several days of the week without feeling like I need caffeine injected into my veins the next morning. But on the days I do manage to stay awake long after the house has gone to bed, I think of it as a special treat for myself and thus the rest of the household. And maybe that's the secret. While the rest of the world dreams, a mother stays awake, not because she must, but because she can, because she is still becoming. And again, that book is called Night Owl Poems. When my therapist diagnosed me with stewardess syndrome, I finally learned to fly. As a first-generation daughter of immigrants, I lived to serve everyone else. Could I learn to serve myself? And this article is by Margarita Bertsos. As a kid, I was unusually invested in the weather. On summer nights, I'd call the time and temperature phone number, this was the early 90s, and listen to a recorded voice telling me tomorrow's forecast. I had it memorized, because if the weather was bad, duty would have to wait. At 9 years old, I was already roped into the family restaurant business. My small hands counting change at the cash register of a seasonal seaside shack on the Connecticut coast. A role I took so seriously that if a customer is even a penny short, I'd stand there unflinching while they rummaged through their purse or pockets for the last coins. By the time I reached my teenage years, my role as a dutiful daughter was firmly established. Dating was out of the question because good Greek girls don't date, even though in a few years everyone will expect you to meet a nice boy and start down the marriage track. Sleepovers didn't happen because other people's parents might be murderers. Even summer break wasn't really a break because when your parents run a restaurant, you've been raised on stories about how they didn't even have shoes growing up. Complaining about scooping ice cream for customers instead of enjoying a cone on the beach wasn't an option. I can't blame my parents for wanting to keep me close, for not leaving me with babysitters while they worked at the restaurant. That was common in tight-knit working-class immigrant families like mine. And besides, my mom was barely more than a child herself when she had me, not even 18. She was doing the best she could with the life she'd quite literally been handed. That life arrived in the form of an arranged marriage to my dad. 2 weeks after they met in rural Greece, they wed. Soon after, they were in the United States chasing the American dream. What they found instead was a life of American duty. Work hard, do what you must to survive, and keep your children safe in a country where you barely know the language. Watching my mother, I learned early that life centered on what had to be done, which may be why the rare moments when she did something just because she wanted to are etched in my memory. One day, I walked into the living room and saw her in leggings and a pink leotard. She was heading to a Richard Simmons-style workout class with my aunt. The relief I felt was enormous. Finally, I thought, she was doing something not for me, not for my dad, not for the household, but simply for herself. As if in unreachable places where she had pushed down her own desires, there is still a sign of life. I hoped the class would become a hobby, but she never went back. Somewhere along the way, I learned wanting wasn't allowed. Duty called the shots. When I first found myself on a therapist's sofa in my 20s, I shared how depleted I was, how exhausting it was to be in relationships that felt lopsided, and got a diagnosis that crystallized a pattern I thought I'd long left behind, stewardess syndrome. Even as I chased my own dreams, moved to New York City, and landed the job I had coveted as an editor at Glamour, I was still carrying it with me. I moved through life like a flight attendant whose sole job was to serve the whims and wants of everyone else. My every interaction signaling, what can I get you? What can I do for you? Only now, instead of serving my family and customers at our restaurant, it was my boss, my friends, the men I dated, even acquaintances who had no real bearing on my life. I couldn't get the visual out of my mind. It was as if I were pushing a bar cart everywhere I went. But instead of tomato juice and peanuts, I was handing out my time, my attention, my eagerness to please. And if there was turbulence, someone else's crisis, someone else's bad mood, someone else's impossible request, I'd keep pushing, doing my damn best to keep everyone calm and happy. Looking back, my shift from serving others to serving myself didn't happen in a flash of clarity. It began with pain and took years. I spent so much effort bending and contorting to please others that I lived most days with a low-grade sadness, numb to all forms of pleasure. Later, I discovered that psychological research has a word for what happens when you live too long out of alignment with yourself: incongruence. It's the split between the life you're actually living and the one some deeper part of you keeps calling you toward. When those two drift too far apart, the body feels it. Stress builds. Resentment creeps in. It's no wonder I felt constantly depleted and had turned to overeating as a refuge. Food had been my drug of choice since childhood. When I was in the middle of a food binge, I ceased feeling everything else that was so intolerable. The sense that I didn't belong here, wherever here was, or the feeling that I wasn't enough, it was the ultimate release. But what looked like overindulgence was actually deprivation. I'd go so long without filling my own cup that eventually I couldn't take it any longer, and I'd binge. Eventually, I spent many of my evenings in church basements in the West Village at 12-step meetings for overeaters. To my surprise, I learned a few basic lessons about being human, lessons that had somehow bypassed me while I was busy trying and never quite managing to be the perfect daughter, employee, friend, and person everyone could rely on. One lesson that began to shift everything for me: people-pleasing is a form of control, an attempt to ensure everyone around you finds you indispensable and likable, a way to earn their love so they'll never leave. A losing strategy, it turns out. When I stopped trying to manage everyone else and their perception of me, a different question began to surface. Who do you want me to be was replaced by who do I want to be? Again, it didn't happen overnight. Desire is a muscle, and mine had atrophied from years of neglect. But the more I flexed it, the more choices I made, big or small, the stronger it grew. At first, these choices were modest but not easy. They felt like small acts of rebellion, bringing equal parts thrill and guilt. Going for a midday workout instead of being the dutiful editor who worked through lunch. Saying no to a bridal shower for some distant cousin I hadn't seen since I was 8. Trying something new, like Greek dancing, for the sheer fun of it. Over time, these choices felt less and less courageous or hard. They became my default operating system. I was no longer the stewardess. I was piloting my own life, listening to the wants that had been drowned out for years. Then one day during the pandemic, my "because I want to" voice pointed me somewhere I never expected to go, Greece. I had been visiting a couple times a year on carefully rationed vacation days, and the place took hold of me. Yes, it was my ancestral homeland, but it wasn't family pulling me there. I couldn't quite explain it. I just knew that the moment I stepped off the plane in Athens, I felt a little freer, a little more myself. At first, my plan was to stay just for 2 months, working remotely while keeping my job in New York media. After several, just a few more weeks extensions, while I was still paying rent on my apartment back home, I finally admitted to myself around the 7-month mark that I wanted Greece to be real life, not just a temporary stint. I've been living here for 5.5 years now. That first month, I stayed in a short-term rental in Volugameni, a seaside neighborhood on the Athenian coast. I logged in for work at 3:30 in the afternoon when the New York office was just waking up, which meant that all day before I sat down at my computer, I had absolutely no shoulds waiting for me. There was no one asking anything of me, no one to care for, no one to check in with, no one to serve. I didn't yet have my go-to spots, my rhythms, my circle of friends. Nothing in my life had hardened into routine or obligation yet. In those early months in Greece, I got to shed my habits and routines and finally go off autopilot. I got to choose again. So I woke up and walked across the street to swim in the sea before work. On the walk home, I picked figs from the trees lining the road and ate them for lunch. My phone wasn't dinging with emails because everyone in New York was still asleep. And for the first time, the only question that mattered was, what do I want to do? Just by being somewhere new, I gave myself permission to be someone new. No one knew me well enough yet to interrupt my decisions with, that's not very Margarita-like. So when the idea struck to rent an apartment in Mykonos for the summer, I did, spending night after night dancing until sunrise and discovering a love for house music. I even dressed differently. Fewer black clothes to flatter or hide my body, more airy skirts and colorful crop tops I never allowed myself to wear in New York. My life has changed drastically in the years I've been living in Greece. When I arrived, being totally independent felt like a relief from my daily, dutiful life. I needed that first year to reset, to intentionally create new rhythms. Now I'm no longer an island unto myself. I fell in love here and married my husband this summer. I have 2 stepsons, friendships that have deepened, and even a close relative who moved here from the States after I did. In other words, there are people around me every day whom I love and show up for. But because I show up for myself, too, their presence is a blessing, not a burden. Sure, the old worry still creeps in sometimes, that if I follow my own direction a little too often, people might fall away, not need me. That without being useful, people won't see me, I'll be invisible. But mostly I've replaced those worries with trust, with the belief that when we show up because we genuinely want to, everyone wins. These days when I show up for people is neither out of obligation nor at my own expense. The bar cart has been stowed away. I show up with a full heart. It feels less like service and more like love. And that turns out to be a far better way to fly. Margarita Bertsos is the creator of the Substack, Because I Want To. She's currently writing a book about desire, reinvention, and what becomes possible when we stop living by obligation. Oprah on the Quiet Courage Within. Honor the strength it takes to face what we did not choose. I learned a new lesson this week and I wanted to share with you all. I understand more profoundly than ever that there are moments in life when compassion deepens, not because we imagine what someone is going through, but because we sit beside them long enough to feel it in our own bones. Recently, I spent the day in a cancer treatment center accompanying a dear friend as she received her first round of chemotherapy for stage 4 lymphoma. I went to offer support. I left with a profound reverence for her, for the journey, and for every soul who has ever walked this path. 12 hours in an infusion chair will teach you things no words could ever could. I have known cancer before, not personally, but as most of us have, through friends, through family, through stories that leave a mark. I have always felt empathy, but this was different. This was witnessing. This was being present as one drug after another slowly entered her body. Chemicals so potent the nurses handled them with gloves and protective care. And yet there she was, receiving them with quiet courage. Halfway through, her blood pressure dropped so suddenly the room shifted, machines paused, the drip stopped. We held our breath with her. What was meant to be 5 hours stretched into 10 hours of uncertainty, of tears, of facing what is without flinching. And then something shifted. The fear that had loomed so large before that first drop began to dissolve. In its place became conversation, reflection, even laughter, a kind of hard-earned lightness. By the end of the day, there was a sense of accomplishment, not because the journey was over, but because the first great hurdle had been crossed. And oh, the grace of the healthcare workers, the steady hands, the unwavering optimism, the way they carry both science and spirit into every room. It takes a special kind of heart to stand in that space day after day and still choose hope. What I left with is this, a deeper respect, not only for the weight of the disease, but for the extraordinary strength it requires and brings to light. Strength that reveals itself in simply enduring, one drip, one hour, one breath at a time. So today's intention is this, to honor the strength it takes to face what we did not choose, and to recognize the quiet courage within ourselves and others that rises up to meet it. If you have walked this road, through cancer, through treatment, through any trial that asked everything of you, I would love to know. What did it teach you about your own strength, and what did you come to understand about the rising that you didn't know before? And these were words from Oprah. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Daily. I hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Tyra Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Oprah Daily is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.
Sometimes it's cold and cruel, baby. No one else will tell you, so we'll never let you.